This is Health First with Kathy Hart, available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We have Dr. William Code with us today, and he has been the author of Solving the Brain Puzzle. He's also been a medical practitioner with over 40 years' experience, and today we're going to talk about the root causes of MS revealed, which he's done a really nice e-book on. So welcome, Bill.
Well, it's nice to be back again, Kathy.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to today's discussion.
Yes, there's so much, so many ways to look at our health and look at ways that we can bring healing. And I think one thing that you bring out again and again in your work is that there's not one silver bullet, that there's so many ways to look and so many little parts of the puzzle that we can work on, and that it's a journey, it's a practice to get well.
So, well, that's right. It takes time and energy, as anybody with a chronic illness, you know, and you more particularly MS, because that's what we're focusing on a bit today. But yeah, you're completely correct. My goal is to empower people to do the changes that they can do, which may help them get well. And happily, you know, virtually none of them have injury to them. So that's a reassuring piece.
That's so great. Now, in your personal life, as well as being a physician and helping people, you came up with MS yourself, right?
That's right. I was diagnosed with it in 96, and I had to leave the operating room, you know, as a full-time anesthetist with lots of chronic pain work. And so it was a big change for me to lose that, lose your career. I was off work long enough. I didn't have any more hospital privileges. But then turned to what choices could I make? And those initially were kind of under complementary and alternative medicine, though now they call it integrative medicine. So that's kind of the shtick that I follow from now.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little about that 2 years of being in the University of Arizona, how it changed or shift the way you looked at medicine?
Well, it really did. The term integrative medicine was coined, I believe, by Andrew Weil, because if you use the term complementary alternative medicine, it often got my physician colleagues kind of back up. You know, there was really no alternative to them in their brain, I think. So I think integrative was a really good choice, and it's spread. It's in majority of medical schools now to some degree, which is a reassuring recurring theme. Mm-hmm. And I did the 2 years, most of it online, but we did 3 1-week sessions together, and it was wonderful to be with, you know, 75 fellow physicians and 5 nurse practitioners of the era, and we became fast friends because we're on much the same track, even though we were from many and varied backgrounds of family practice to neurology, psychiatry, surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Myself as an anesthesiologist. So it was a very eclectic group. It was really exciting, and it, to be honest, most of these were women, about two-thirds were women, because I think they're more willing to look outside the regular box sooner.
Right. Is that changing, Bill? Do you think that's changing now in the integrative medicine field?
I think I find the early adapters tend more often to be women. I was at an integrative conference in San Francisco, well-attended, put together by Andrew Weil and others. And there was probably 400 people there, and 80% were women, which was just tells me. And it's usually, not always, but it's often young women in their 30s and 40s. They're just looking for other answers because they're a bit frustrated with the relative lack of flexibility. And that's an extra challenge, of course.
And so that's almost like letting go of that paternal, patriarchal idea that you go to that white coat and be told
what
to do.
That's right, and the white coat is kind of God, and my goal is to empower people to that really they're in charge, and the more you know about your own entity, the more you can do for yourself.
Absolutely. So what is some of the root causes that you found and some of the tests that are so important to have done if you're unwell and you're thinking possibly, you know, inflammation, nervous system breakdown? What are some of the tests that we should be looking for and asking our doctors for?
Well, and, you know, I've outlined those to you, and people could certainly go to my website and get that free ebook about the tests themselves. And I will discuss the tests a little bit, but probably easiest to, in the beginning, say that it's my belief, and I didn't coin this. It was coined by a physician in Scotland originally, but MS more optimally would describe microvascular syndrome. Multiple sclerosis literally means multiple scars. So if you'd had multiple surgeries on your belly, you would be theoretically a multiple sclerosis, multiple scar person, and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But in reality, what's happening in the brain primarily, a little bit in the spinal cord too sometimes, but in the brain is that they're very tiny vessels. So these are 5 to 100 microns, and 5 microns or 7 microns actually is the size of an ordinary red blood cell. So we're talking quite small here, hence the word micro. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be blockages within that or injury to the wall lining of that. And so everybody accepts, no matter whether you think MS is an autoimmune disease or it's a microvascular syndrome entity, everybody accepts that MS is too much inflammation in parts mm-hmm. of the brain, and it's a leaky blood-brain barrier. So the blood-brain barrier is actually that blood vessel lining, you know, the endothelium.
Right.
And that's what goes awry. So anything that can trigger it going awry, and the three things that I typically list easy to think about, one is fat emboli. So this is, and there's a case in the literature talking about this person had a blow on the shoulder, you know, a fat emboli. I mean, think of the one that we've always talked about is spanking, unfortunately, initiating fat emboli. So the emboli can travel, and sometimes they will get through the filter of the lungs, and as a consequence, they lodge up in that irritated or relatively low oxygen part of the brain, which takes on the injury. Hmm. And then, so that fat emboli is one. A second one is LPS, which is lipopolysaccharide, and so that comes from a leaky gut. So gram-negative bacteria, which are a common thing in the gut, when they die, their cell lining goes into the bloodstream if you've got a leaky gut problem, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they're in the brain, and they can trigger the same irritation. And there's models in the literature for that, that is a way to trigger MS in both an animal model and probably also triggers it to some in humans. And then the third one, and this is one I think that the testing that we can even do in our regular labs may give some idea toward, and that's microvessel, you know, or tiny blood clots forming in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So just like, almost like a miniature stroke, because we know that happens in migraine headache, but it also probably happens in MS. And that's, this extra clotability happens in about 15% of the population. So that's a lot of us.
Right.
It's an interesting time because this is often aggravated, for example, by COVID, or any infection will aggravate that scenario. So mm-hmm. that's one reason, you know, that possibility. And most people know if they're really super clotters, they think, well, that's wonderful, give themselves a pat on the back. But it may not be in their best interest as far as the heart health or kidney health or brain health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some simple ways, other than, like, there's the e-book is fantastic for getting through all the different panels and all the things that you should be checked for. But when it comes right down to the rubber meeting the road, what are some things that we can do in our bodies to alleviate the inflammation and alleviate the leaky gut?
Well, I'm really keen on alleviating the leaky gut, and so I've been pretty good about being gluten-free, you know, for 23 years. I mean, I didn't get on it right away, but I got on it in a while when I was diagnosed. But I was much poorer at going dairy-free, because unfortunately, if you're gluten-sensitive, you got about an 80% chance of being dairy-sensitive, because they have the same amino acids at the end, and so that's how the body sees them. And so I was always a junkie for ice cream and certain things, so I wasn't as good getting there. But we do know that if you take that out of your diet, it really does allow the gut to heal up better. And so within about 3 months, one will be noticing some change. And the other piece that really helps that is reducing the number of foods that you eat that have Roundup in them. And unfortunately, it's used to harvest wheat, so you've already taken that out, so that's a good thing. It's quite prevalent, unfortunately, also in dairy, because our dairy cows eat a lot of Roundup-containing foods. And then the other ones that we don't realize are things like ordinary potatoes, sweet potatoes, and both beet sugar and cane sugar. So those, if you can grow your own or reach for organic, you'll then be reducing. Because the Roundup aggravates that leaky gut problem. It aggravates your own gut bacteria dramatically because it's an antibiotic, unfortunately, and patented as such. And it also shuts down the liver's detoxifying pathways. So that means you're more susceptible to, you know, toxins of any type, whether it's in your air, water, or food.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bill, if we're going to a certified organic wheat, we've still got the gluten, but is it easier for our bodies to digest? Or should we just, like, throw all the wheat out?
A little, but not dramatically so.
Okay.
So my preference is if you're battling a major illness, which is partly gut origin, potentially, it's better to go the whole deal and avoid wheat completely. And happily, there's some, you know, pretty good oats, for example, that can be grown away from wheat and barley, and then they can certify it as such. So that's pretty available and reasonably inexpensive. And, of course, there's the other brilliant grains like, well, I'm not sure buckwheat's a grain, but it's close enough,
mm-hmm.
as well as quinoa and even rice or wild rice.
Okay. So just let it go if you're feeling inflamed or if you feel like the gut lining is not really happy.
Exactly. And we used to think that you would have gut symptoms, but not everybody does. But there's a huge crossover between gut irritability and so-called problems with inflammatory bowel, you know, problems.
Right.
And MS, it's about a 70% crossover. If they have one, they usually often have the other. And so it's a clue, and, you know, at least you'll be reducing that problem as well in the scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, and so, you know, that's why if people go to that or to my website and look up that book, they can also get quite an expert on healing the gut, and that's Christina Mitz, who co-wrote that piece online with me. And, you know, tells about how to contact her and how she can help you work through. She was a trained expert within fecal microbial transplant, or gut floral transplant, I think is a better name.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that isn't directly offered in Canada because of Health Canada's suggestions, except for C. diff, then, you know, she helps people work toward it with prebiotics, probiotics, and other possibilities that can help that gut healing portion.
Mm-hmm. And she is a nutritionist.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So there's added a lot to our ability to work through the gut problems. What about latent viruses like Epstein-Barr you mentioned in there can create a lot of havoc that even many, many years after you might have had mono.
Well, that's right. It can be, you know, a component within it. And as I mentioned, 95% of folks with MS have had Epstein-Barr. I mean, I had it diagnosed twice, not supposed to ever get these again. But, you know, I think it can linger in the body, much like herpes simplex for canker sores can linger in the body. It just does.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the virus component, you know, reaches across, and it may be one of the pieces of the puzzle. Well, you can't change yesterday about the Epstein-Barr, but you can do ways to help keep your virus at bay, so to speak, or relatively asleep, and that's by having and these apply, of course, to COVID, having a good zinc intake, a good vitamin D intake, and vitamin D, get it measured here in BC, because it helps the gut health and the gut lining. And those are two big ones as far as avoiding problems, and even doing a gram of vitamin C a day, or 500 twice a day. Each of these are things that we could all do in today's fear about the worry about COVID, then those would be extra to do. And having had COVID now and tested positive for the antibodies, you know, I used all of those pieces, including a couple more, and it made a huge difference. And so, you know, that's one piece behind me, because everybody worries in the presence of MS, what should you do?
Right, right. So you've actually had COVID and overcome it?
That's right.
And were you on the zinc and D and vitamin C and all that through the whole process?
I did. Yeah, I took a large amount of vitamin D at the get-go and used those in the process. I also had oxygen with me because I always travel with extra oxygen because I use it at night. I think it improves the blood vessel health through the night as I sleep because all of us, you know, our oxygen drops a little. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue within that part of the brain is a relative lack of oxygen. It's not a full-on stroke, but it's a little lower than you'd like. And any time it's lower than you'd like, then that blood-brain barrier or endothelium is more at risk of injury from those little emboli.
Interesting. We're going to have to go to a quick break, and let's talk about how to get more oxygen in our system when we get back.